this morning we were to do a program about Michael Vreeland, and we're going to do a program about Michael Vreeland with or without Michael Vreeland.
For those unfamiliar with the story of Delmar Vreeland, he alleges to be a officer of naval intelligence who, after a trip to Russia in late November of 2000, returned to Toronto to take some documents, which he acquired in Moscow, to various contacts here in Toronto. Long and the short of it is, the documents weren't delivered because there were, the meeting was blown. We'll get into the reasons for that later as well. After his arrest, he is alleged to have written a warning note regarding September 11th, which he had sealed by the people who were his jailers up in Lindsay, Ontario, first of Ontario's new super jails. The letter was later opened by officials at the jail on or about September 14th. There's been a lot of discussion since then in the courts and in the press and on the radio about the validity of Lieutenant Vreeland's story. He and Mike Rupert and others certainly have a lot to say in support of what Lieutenant Vreeland has been saying. In addition to predicting what happened on September 11th, he was also able to somewhat accurately predict the cause of death of a Canadian diplomat named Mark Bastion, who was originally thought to be to have died of natural causes. It was later determined by the Quebec Coroner's Office that he was in fact poisoned, something that Mr. Vreeland had contended since, I believe, April this year, when he when the RCMP and CSIS responded to a letter that he wrote to Bastion in June of 2000, I believe it is. We've been able to figure out a certain amount about what the note says already. That says Navy Pier, according to Mike Rupert. Mike Rupert's done a lot of the reporting on Vreeland so far. Mike Rupert is also somebody who will just acknowledge at this point has impeccable credentials, a former LAPD officer
right.
that looks into exactly this kind of thing on a frequent basis. He was able to confirm a few things that we'd thought about the contents of the letter. It says Navy Pier, Sears Tower, Chicago, World Trade Center, White House, Pentagon. There is a question mark between Sears Tower and Chicago and right. after Pentagon. World Bank, I think it says Malaysia there, one of three references to that country on this note. It also says water supplies, Scotia Building, Toronto, Parliament Building, Ottawa, Royal Bank. I believe that says Toronto or Montreal after that. Lieutenant Vreeland contends that this is actually two pieces of paper that we're looking at here that have been folded together. This was so that he could hide the note inside another book when he's in jail. The bottom of this list of targets is what they appear to be, or in hindsight would appear to be, is a line that says, "Let one happen, stop the rest." And
That's under answer, right? He has a problem answer type question here, right? So first he's saying, they will paint me crazy and call me a liar. Then he says, let one happen, stop the rest.
We should mention that this note was written on August 11th. There's been some testimony to corroborate this in courts in Canada, in Toronto, in fact.
What we're looking at here is a note that is from a court binder. It's been rebound. And then it's also been stamped, and then at the very top right, also a page number has been indicated, or some form of number for documents. We've got a 197 in a circle, which I don't believe is part of the original note, and then you've got a stamp, a court stamp. It's a, what does that say down?
This is Exhibit N.
The authority of DEMJ Vreeland, sworn before me, which is probably the judge, this 7th day of October 2001, and then that's the judge's signature right there.
Now, as we were saying, it's contended that he had this sealed by people in the jail on or about August 11th of 2001. It was unsealed by people who knew what was in it at the jail on September 14th, a couple days after the terrorist attacks in the United States.
Right. Now, the one thing is that there is no date implied on this.
Well, there were three years mentioned in various parts of the note. One is the year 2007, one is right. the year 2009.
I see that. What's
Lieutenant Vreeland alleges that this has something to do with the Chinese getting the Olympics.
And the third date?
1996-97, down at the very bottom.
Yeah, CR slash...
He claims that this has something to do with an arms agreement, a bilateral arms agreement between China and Russia.
CR?
China, Russia.
Right.
Mike Rupert was kind enough to tell us that he believes the name Mark, M-A-R-C, that appears in the left-hand column actually does refer to Mark Bastion, which is the Canadian diplomat, it turns out, was murdered.
Right.
Kathleen Harris, who's a woman who writes, I guess, for the Sun, wrote a really great, although fairly lengthy article that hopefully we'll get to talk to her about at some time, about Mark Bastion's death. When his body was returned to his family, December 19th, they said that the body was in such bad shape that they never actually went to identify it themselves, that they left it to a friend of the family who knew what Bastion looked like, who worked for the Undertaker or whatever they call those people in the world these
mortuary.
Days.
Mortuary. Yeah. Mortuary engineer.
Apparently, that individual was left to identify the body because it was in quote-unquote, such bad shape.
Yeah.
Now, my question is,
no refrigerators.
7 days after he was murdered, December 12th, 2000, he was murdered by poison, which was found to be an anti-schizophrenia medication, a fairly heavy antipsychotic drug.
So overdose.
Possibly that one would not take recreationally, right. One would have to assume.
Who knows?
It was alleged that he had it with alcohol. It killed him.
Right.
But the thing is, if he was poisoned, how 7 days later is his body in such bad shape that his family cannot go identify it? Come on, Russians certainly have more technology.
The
not according to
Vreeland. Don't you think?
Vreeland is always saying the Russians are inept.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's his basic theme.
But yeah, you're right. Poisoning tends not to corrode the body as heavily as, let's say, being chopped under a lawnmower, for example, would. That doesn't seem to be a...
Well, yeah, I can see if he was hacked to death by a chainsaw murderer.
Right.
His body would be in bad shape.
Right.
But poisoning, a mere 7 days later...
Right.
I mean,
right.
Certainly the body wouldn't have decomposed so much that his family couldn't identify it. Well, this leads me to think that there's actually more to the story than we're being told at this point. And
also,
I would love to know what Mr. Vreeland had to say about that.
Wouldn't it be wonderful to know? Also, I remember there was one part where it said that the family had sent Mark Bastion a note days and days before about some favorite nephew of his. And he had mysteriously never replied to that, whereas in the past he would have. That was what they pointed to being sort of suspicious prior to the date of the death.
They're in Quebec. Somewhere after being told Mark's body was in bad shape, no member of the Bastion family made a positive identification when Mark was returned to Canada. They left the job to a funeral home worker who knew their son. Bastion, as a diplomat working at the Canadian embassy, had done stints throughout Europe and in Japan, China, India, Pakistan. But Moscow was his first long-term posting. He left Canada on September 7th, the day Mr. Vreeland contends he received his orders regarding what they were going to be doing in Moscow, and we'll talk about that shortly as well. He left in September 7th. 3 months later, he was delivered home by military aircraft, his body wrapped in a blanket inside a steel box. A half-full bottle of beer, apparently forensic evidence, was shipped back with the body. His father speculated in this article that his son may have been murdered. The family seems to have made various conflicting statements about whether or not, or what in fact happened to their son. We should mention also he was a 35-year-old healthy individual. Very unlikely that he would have died of natural causes, as the government contended for a full year up until late 2001, early this year, when the information was released to the public through the newspapers, through this article by Kathleen Harris. There was an abbreviated version of this published in the Toronto Sun. And also there was another article which confirmed this information, a Canadian press article that the Star published in January of 2002.
On this note, do you think this is Jorge Haider? George Haider, however you pronounce it?
Haider is in the Middle East about as popular a last name as Smith or Jones is
really?
Here. I've never heard anyone actually explain who Dr. Haider, who was referred to on this note.
The significance of the White House versus the Canadian Parliament buildings, as you said, really is not in balance.
This note was written August 2001. He was arrested in Toronto.
On what charges?
This is an area of some debate. All of the Canadian charges have been dropped. Subsequently, Mr. Vreeland has been released from custody. And he has an extradition trial pending over a warrant in Michigan where there's some alleged fraud. This is a whole area that I was hoping we would get into in a little while. There are numerous articles in the press, very easy to find information on the internet about Delmard Vreeland's criminal history.
Mr. Vreeland was supposed to be here this morning with his lawyer, Paul Slansky. Now, we have only had confirmation that Mr. Slansky would be here from Mr. Vreeland himself. We've had no confirmation, although I did phone Mr. Slansky's office earlier this week in order to get confirmation from him that he would be here. I've never had a call back from Mr. Slansky's office at any time that I've phoned in the last 2 to 3 months, and that's how long we've been really following this story heavily on the air. I feel it fair to say, after our interview with Mr. Rupert, that the call went through from Mr. Rupert to Mike Vreeland saying that the interview that we had done with Rupert was negative.
Quote, unquote?
Yes, and warned Mr. Vreeland about coming in this morning. Now, I don't know whether that played in any way into Mr. Vreeland's decision, if I'm assuming it is his decision not to arrive here this morning. Of course, we're very disappointed that Mr. Vreeland didn't show up, because the whole point of having this program on was to clarify certain issues that we're just not sure of. If we play the Mike Rupert interview, I mean, there are lots of things that he doesn't understand or doesn't remember, and it is hard to keep the whole thing straight.
You were referring to the timeline. I would love to spend a little bit of time on this.
All right. I have, from the Rents interview,
okay,
which we have permission to run, from Mr. Jeff Rents.
Thank you, Mr. Rents.
Yes, thank you very much. You can go to rents.com and hear the entire thing.
When was the Rents interview done?
14th? Mine was April 14th.
His was the 17th.
Okay.
If we're to start chronologically, we should mention before we start that Lieutenant Vreeland's family has a long history in naval intelligence. He says his great-great-grandfather was the head of naval intelligence at the turn of the century. I did some research on my own, discovered that he was the first director of the Office of Naval Intelligence. There are also boats in the U.S. Navy that bear the Vreeland family name. In the Rents interview, alluded to the fact that Vreeland was very likely groomed for his position in naval intelligence. We should start with the time Lieutenant Vreeland joins the Navy, which is 1984. I believe he's 18 years old at that time, if I've done my homework right. 1986 moves into naval intelligence, I believe.
That lines up with what Rupert was saying about him being in Los Angeles in 1986. At the age of 22, he said.
1986, I believe he would have been 20, in fact.
Okay, well, Rupert says...
Our date of birth for Mr. Vreeland is June 20th, 1966.
Right, and Rupert refers to him as 22 years old at that time, during the Rents interview.
Yes, I am aware of that. There's a small discrepancy there. So, as you mentioned, that's the first mention in the press that anyone has pointed out to us, anyway, of Mr. Vreeland's fairly strange story. He appears as a friendly witness, as the next-door neighbor of a very big cocaine dealer who was caught with, according to Rupert, 400 kilos of cocaine. It's more than personal use, I believe. So that's entering Scarface territory right there, I think. One of the things that concerns us a great deal is if you type the name Delmard Vreeland into a search engine like Google, a lot of the stuff that comes up relates to events that implicate him or would seem to indicate he has some kind of criminal history. I guess the first one that I came across myself was an article from September 5th, 1999 from the Macomb Daily. Now, this is a county in Michigan, close to the Detroit area. It's a story about a guy named Moore, Robert Moore. Is that right?
Yes, of Bobby Moore's Steakhouse fame in the Detroit area, at least.
Bobby Moore's Steakhouse and Seafood Grill was the name of this restaurant. There was an arson at the restaurant. There was a trial in which one of Mr. Moore's alleged co-conspirators testified that he set up a meeting between Mr. Moore and the person who committed the arson, and there was something about $10,000 payment in there. And I'll read from the article. Judge Crouchman found little credibility in the testimony of Moore's alleged co-conspirator, Delmart Vreeland of Bloomfield Hills, which is an upscale suburb of Michigan. Vreeland testified that he arranged a meeting between Moore and a man who was to make $10,000 for starting the blaze. That's from the Macomb Daily, September 1999. One thing that I want to mention about this is that this is an example, not unlike the example that Rupert mentions in the article that he found in the LA Times from 86, where Lieutenant Vreeland has been called upon to testify at a trial. This guy Moore had a real hotshot lawyer, and that Delmart Vreeland's testimony was considered by the court to be fairly questionable, according to press articles at the time. There's also an article from the Detroit Free Press from around the same time. The article in the Detroit Free Press says that Delmart Vreeland is Bobby Moore's step-brother-in-law. I quote from the article.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The next time that Delmart Vreeland appears in the press is in an article in the Detroit News. One of the first things that comes up when you search Delmart Vreeland's name in Google, ID theft suspect eludes police, in which a police officer named Sergeant Keith Fry, he's a lieutenant now, by the way. He's gotten a promotion, I understand. From the Troy Police Department, makes many allegations about Delmart Vreeland, including wherever he goes, there seems to be a trail of fraud, deceit, and crime. It is alleged that Mr. Fry's department is one of several with outstanding criminal warrants for Vreeland. Birmingham police detective is quoted in this story, whose name is Douglas Manigold. Apparently says that Delmart Vreeland got in a fight with an Indiana police officer in February and managed to get bonded out on someone else's name. That's the last we can place him. Doesn't give a time frame for that, unfortunately.
What year is this, Ron?
This article is April 27th of 2000.
Okay. So this is approximately seven or eight months prior to his arrest in Toronto.
Yes, and about 6 months prior to his trip to Moscow that he speaks in quite a bit of depth, actually, I believe, in the Rents interview and in the interview you did with him before.
And also I should note that records suggest, and some of these are contradictory, that it would appear from the rap sheets that we're seeing that a Delmart Vreeland was incarcerated anywhere between 1988
and 1996.
What
you're referring to is the Michigan Department of Corrections records, which are freely available on their website. We've noticed some pretty serious inconsistencies in what those documents appear to tell us, and we should definitely address those. But before we get, I just want to continue on with this article.
Yes.
From the Detroit News. It also quotes, a private investigator that was hired to hunt Vreeland, quoting from the article again, whose name is Al Booz. Greg and I love this guy's name. He was hired by a salesperson who took a $40,000 hit from Vreeland just before Christmas. The next day, Vreeland returned and paid $3,000 again by credit card for a decorated Christmas tree. According to Al Booz, he lives it up on other people's good credit. Last I heard, he stole a Porsche from an Indiana dealership where a list of workers' social security numbers was stolen. But at around the same time, there's a report produced by ABC TV in Detroit on their website. There's a couple different pages of information. One is that Delmart Vreeland is on Metro Detroit's most wanted list. It lists a number of charges after the warrant information, including probation violation, forgery, unlawful flight to avoid prosecution, counterfeiting, fail to return rental vehicle, larceny by conversation, narcotics, reckless endangerment, defrauding an innkeeper, arson, forgery, grand theft, and another failed to return rental vehicle, and lists a large number of aliases that Mr. Vreeland is alleged to have used in the past. There's also, as I mentioned, an article that we thought was fairly interesting for the reason that accompanying this article was a photograph, which we believe is supposed to be Delmart Vreeland. The article's about two different gentlemen, a guy named Larry McGee, who's some drug dealer, and Delmart Vreeland. Both of the information from this article comes from the Oakland County Sheriff's Department, Oakland County, Michigan, this is. In this article, he's had as many as 27 aliases. Once again, a lot of talk of stolen identities. mentions the fact Captain McCabe of the Oakland County Sheriff's Department claims that he's wanted in six different states right now. The picture, though, that accompanied that is quite different than any of the other pictures that we've seen of Vreeland on the Oakland County Sheriff's Department site, and on we found a photograph also on the Florida Department of Corrections website. Clearly not the same person as is in the photograph that accompanied this article.
Tell the listeners what happened to that ABC news article.
I contacted the person who maintains the website, who actually puts the story up there. It turns out she's a woman from Kitchener, Ontario, so I thought, okay, in. She's Canadian. She's got to answer by email. Very few of these people do. I managed to get in touch with her anyway and sent her a text copy of the article to refresh her memory. I wanted to know who she'd talked to about the story, if there had been any updated information. I had a number of questions about the article. She wrote back to me that she couldn't remember the article, despite the fact that I included the text of the article in my email, and that, in fact, the article had been taken off of their website. I had a link to the article on their website, on my website, so I just went there, copied the URL, sent it back to her, and I said, look, this is the article on your website. You just told me it's not there. What's going on? I wanted to know about the picture as well. Where the hell did you get that picture from? Never asked that question. She wrote back that, once again, she couldn't remember anything about the article, that she doesn't actually write the story. She gave me the number of their news director. I haven't been able to follow up with him yet, but will be. Within an hour of sending her the URL, the article was no longer on their website. So if I just kept my mouth shut...
And this article also appears... strangely, on a site of an Australian biker.
Yes, who I was able to contact also. Originally, I couldn't find the article on the Detroit ABC News site. I found it on this biker guy, this Australian biker guy's website. You'd love him, Barbara Fish. After that, we get to the Michigan Department of Corrections website information, which indicates that he was in jail related to charges, an offense in 1984, he was sentenced in 1988 and discharged in 1996. It also says earlier in 1988 than when he was sentenced in July of 1988. There was another charge for which he was also convicted in 1989 and kept in custody until 1996. Ditto for another charge. Two of them are from Grand Traverse County, Michigan. One is receiving stolen property. One is breaking and entering a building with intent. The first one I mentioned is from Wayne County, Michigan, and it's another break-and-enter charge. This is interesting to us for one reason and one reason only, and that is that apparently in 1991 in Macomb County, in a different county other than which he is alleged to be in jail, there's another offense, uttering and publishing. I checked the charge. It's relating to false documents and passing bad checks, an offense that is said to be committed in 1991. Now, keep in mind that he's in jail, according to the same documents, from 1988 till 1996. So how does he commit a crime in a different place in 1991? I mean, I doubt they let you take checkbooks into jail. I'm not positive about this.
Charges or convictions?
Convictions.
These are all convictions, according to this information. Now, we have reason to question, seriously question, whether this information is accurate. We should say that as a disclaimer at the very least, because people, including Mike Rupert, believe that these records were created in order for him to have a cover for some of his covert work, which would explain a lot, which would explain why none of it makes sense, for example. That would be the simple explanation I've been able to come up with. Once again, had Lieutenant Vreeland been here, we would hope that he would be able to confirm that.
And also, our suspicions are extended because of the different pictures that we have. And, of course, we're not able to establish, because Mr. Vreeland didn't show up today, whether
he even resembles
either of them
in the pictures.
Was he not amenable even to a phone interview if he couldn't make
He's
it
done a phone
person?
Interview with him in the past. He's been doing appearances lately with his lawyer, Paul Slansky, who would have had to have been present also. I guess we don't want to give away too many details about this morning. No one here would have any objection to talking to him on the phone, that's for sure. We would love it
I
right
left.
Now.
Yeah.
So if you're listening, fella, give a ring.
I should mention quickly also we found stuff on the Florida Department of Corrections website that give details of two charges in two different counties, both grand theft, one between $20,000 and $100,000, one grand theft over $100,000. We also found some court records that were very difficult to make sense of from Leon County. There was a really interesting article about when he was captured, but now I'm getting ahead of myself. I think that what we should do now is maybe give Mike Rupert, on behalf of Lieutenant Vreeland, a chance to talk about what we've discussed so far. Oh, sound good to you?
Yes. So this is the interview that Ron and I did on Thursday, this past Thursday evening.
Mike Rupert, immediately before his trip to Australia, shortly before his canceled appearance on Geraldo last night.
And right. Mike Rupert is phoning.
Mike Rupert is a former LAPD officer and these days an investigative journalist with impeccable credentials.
And he's phoning in from California.
And he... and he also has been on the leading edge of suggesting or putting together information that the Bush administration knew
in advance about
of
September 11th.
9/11.
It's fitting that we should be doing this now because this is truly Mike Rupert's finest hour. Mm-hmm. He's got to be loving it.
Right.
And Mr. Vreeland, too.
Yeah.
Let's fast forward to December of 2000. Or actually, no, September of 2000. Mark Bastian and Lieutenant Vreeland, according to Lieutenant Vreeland, both received their orders regarding a trip to Moscow they were about to embark on. He made comments during an interview that he did with Greg on April 14th on International Connection that he flew from Sudbury to Moscow and back within the space of... 4 or 5 days at the end of November 2000. I think it's probably best to leave him to explain himself what he was actually doing in Russia. This is from an interview he did with Jeff Rentz on April 17th.
Right.
All right, so you're going off to Moscow to meet someone, but you went to Moscow for the first time, correct?
That wasn't the first time I've ever been in Moscow, but that was the first time I ever went to Moscow to... do something of this magnitude.
What was the earlier trip to Moscow about?
They were having a Star Wars convention, and there were people from around the world that had gathered there to discuss certain issues of the Star Wars technology. Mm-hmm. And I was sent there as well as to the Netherlands in 1996 by Admiral Jeremy Michael Borda before his alleged suicide. I was sent over there to observe the same thing. I was just observing and listening and taking in the knowledge. I mean, no one knew that I was with military. I was just there.
Just to find out what you thought about the concepts that were being offered and talked about, just to get your reaction to it, is that what it was?
Yes. And to try to tape it, get as much as I could on tape.
Mm-hmm.
These are private settings where certain individuals can get in with right credential, but mm-hmm. you can't go in there and tape record and videotape.
Sure.
And
were you wired?
Oh, yeah.
Now, it should be noted there in the middle of that clip, he mentions...
A very interesting name.
Yeah. Is it right? Rear Admiral Borda?
Borda is the gentleman's last name. It's B-O-O-R-D-A, if anyone is interested in looking up this information for themselves. But
very high-ranking official in the Navy. He was supposedly a victim of suicide. Although it is stated that he shot himself twice in the chest. Now, one, it's very difficult to shoot yourself twice in the chest, but Clinton gave his eulogy.
The alleged suicide took place under less than, under fairly suspicious circumstances.
Right. And the suspicious circumstances were that he was about to be interviewed by journalists who were going to be suggesting that one of his medals that he had was saying that he had obtained was obtained fraudulently, or that he was wearing a medal that he didn't really garner the honors for. He went out prior to the journalists' arrival who were scheduled to come and interview him, and he went home, and that's where he died. However which way he did die, whether it was a suicide or a murder. It should also be noted that he appears to be the person who made a decision based on the Srebrenica market bombing the supposed shelling that was done by Bosnian Serb forces, which has become come into contention as to whether the shells actually came from the Serbian forces. It was he who decided that bombing must occur. And Borda's death was in 1996.
The same year, Lieutenant Vreeland alleges that he gave him orders to attend a conference regarding Star Wars technology, something that Vreeland claimed he was working on. In fact, he claims he designed a system for Star Wars that was also part of the reason he went to Moscow in late November of 2000. According to Vreeland, well, what he was there to do was, in fact, through contacts of Mark Bastian, acquire documents from a Russian ministry and change them and plant them back into where he got them from originally to make a piece of technology that the Russians had documents to build completely inoperable.
Taking a little dramatic license here, this man decided for half to a mil to pull this book out and let you have a look at it. You were going to do more than look at it, I'm sure, but that was your assignment to go over there. And so tell me what happened.
Well, this man was allowed to remove these things because he was working on certain projects, so he could remove stuff and take it with him.
Okay.
As long as he stayed within the confines of a specific building. I got my hands on the book, and I didn't go alone. I had another person with me. Basically, I needed somebody who could, as quick as possible, translate the document out of Russian. So we copied the entire book. We translated the document.
How did you copy the entire book? Photocopy?
We photocopied it.
Okay.
Off of Kropotkin.
What does that mean?
It's just a street.
Oh, okay. All right. What, a photocopy store? You walked into a restaurant?
No, there was an apartment on Kropotkin that we had set up.
You had the equipment in there. Okay.
We had an apartment set up with everything we needed in it to do this as quick as possible. We copied the entire thing. The whole thing was translated. And then what we did is we took documents and we altered them. Look, we removed certain portions of the book and the designs that were in it. And basically, we inserted things like schematic boards for, hypothetically, a Sony PlayStation. You know, we just completely screwed the entire design up is what we did. And once I redid the diagrams in English from the translated portion, they were then translated back to Russian.
This is all done in longhand or on a computer?
No, it's all done through computer. Basically, what would happen is, as time progressed, if they built the system, there would come a day when they tried to put it online and it's not going to work. We redesigned that document, so once they got to that point, it would not work.
How much time did you have to do this?
About 72 hours.
Around the clock?
No. The book had to go back in at certain times and then come back out.
Oh. Who got it in and out, can you tell me? How did that work?
It was Bastian's contact.
He just walked it in and walked it out?
No, basically it was done through a window.
Honest to goodness, a window?
Yes.
Somebody walks up next to a window, it comes out, and it's there?
That's the story.
Do you know why he mentions the PlayStation? Because there was a big story in the news. Everyone knew about this in CNN and various other articles were mentioned about that. When Sony PlayStation 2 came first out of Japan, the U.S. government looked at it, at the components, and saw that they were very, very high-tech pieces of equipment to do this whole gaming console. And they actually restricted its movement and its sale around the world for just a short period of time, and then they just released it, and that now everyone can go and can get one. But it was considered a military, quote-unquote, military threat at a specific point in time. So that's one reason, I guess, why Delmart Mike Vreeland mentions PlayStation 2.
Okay. Thank you.
We're going to be now up to when he returns to Toronto. He's supposed to meet with two contacts here in Toronto. They weren't identified in other interviews, but just this past Wednesday on KPFA, he had previously been referring to them as the Canadian and the Russian contact he was supposed to meet in Toronto. We've established since that time the Canadian contact was Mark Bastian, whose death Delmart Vreeland somewhat accurately predicted the cause of. And a gentleman named, is it Oleg? Who was the Russian contact who we at the present time know nothing about. Bastian did not show at what was supposed to be the meeting. And according to Vreeland, when this kind of meeting is set up a certain way and it doesn't go the way it's supposed to go, your job is to get yourself out of the situation as quickly as possible. I'm still a little unclear to the dummy bag thing. Okay, what he did is apparently passed off dummy documents to the Russian gentleman who did show for the meeting. I guess he'll explain here what he actually did in his own words.
One of them is a Russian individual. Another one is a Canadian diplomat. The Canadian one is the one that I'm to trust the most.
Does ONI give you this assignment? Is this still part of your assignment?
What, coming back into Toronto and doing what I'm doing?
And meeting with the Russian and the Canadian?
Yes.
All right.
The Canadian does not show up. Only the Russian individual shows up. He asked me for the bag and gave me some cheap excuse for why the other individual was not there.
Mm-hmm.
When he told me that, I said, no problem. I didn't want to get my head blown off on the street so this guy could snatch a bag from me, so I gave him a dummy bag.
With dummy doc. Did you anticipate there might be trouble? And if so, how did you come up with dummy documents? Was that your idea, or was that someone above you telling you, you better protect yourself just in case?
No, that's just the way I do things. I just prepare myself.
It's called survival. I understand.
There's no guarantee that they're going to show up and somebody else isn't going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
If the meeting does not go exactly as it is planned,
mm-hmm.
it's a red flag,
mm-hmm.
and you do what you need to do to get out of that meeting and get to a safe point. Call someone, whoever your contact or handler is, explain to them exactly what happened, and then explain why you did not hand over what you were supposed to do, because basically you're violating an order. So I took the order, and I went back, but I brought nothing with me.
Who'd you meet?
I didn't meet anybody.
Nobody showed?
No. Who showed up was the fugitive squad from Toronto.
You were right.
When I went back that night, the exact same place that we were supposed to meet, on the 6th, I was greeted by many members of the Toronto Fugitive Squad and other individuals who were there who've never come forward to say who they were. I was in a white limousine in a line of limousines, and they pegged my limousine like they knew I was in that car.
Did you go to the first meeting and the second meeting in white limousines, and why the white limousine?
No, well, the reason was is because there was a wedding that night on the 6th. I checked it out. I knew where it was going to take place. So what I did is I rented a limousine from a place about 2 hours away from Toronto, and went back down there in this limousine and just had the limo driver get in line. Not even the limo driver knew what was going on. So he pulled up in the line. I made the call and told him, I'm here. The minute I hung up, I'd give it probably 5 minutes tops. They beamed down on me and surrounded that limousine. Then they pull me out of the limousine. They cuff me. They tell me, you're under arrest. I said, for what? He said, for fraud. The next words out of my mouth were, you know what, when I find out who set me up like this, I'm going to kill him. And then they added the charge of threatening death. But I said it. I mean, them were my words. And
what kind of fraud did you had to ask
they
about
didn't say.
That?
Well, at that time, I wasn't concerned about the fraud. I was concerned mm-hmm. about what was really going on and if these people were really police officers or what. I had no clue who they were.
Did the thought occur to you, this is a little melodramatic, termed, for whatever reason, because of the blown first meeting, termed expendable by your own superiors?
I'm beginning to believe that, and that was basically the reason why I refused to go back the second time with the documents. I went back the second time, but I didn't bring them with me. Now, they did extensive damage to this man's limousine, and I, for the life of me, I can't figure out for what reason they can claim to rip up the limousine if they weren't looking for something very serious.
Now, this brings up a very good question that would need to be asked right here, which is, you had not, Mike, at this point, opened the pouch, or you were not aware of what was in it, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so the question then becomes, why would you have been deemed expendable if it was known that you hadn't been aware of what was in the pouch?
Basically, it's really hard to explain, but it's like when somebody gives me orders and I have orders on paper and they're telling me I'm to follow this route A to Z, and it's going to happen exactly like this. I mean, you don't divert from what's supposed to happen unless you absolutely have to. And when one person shows up and I just say, no, this is not going to happen, and I give a dummy bag up, and I call back to where I called and I explained it to him, And this individual tells me, you go back there and you make this meeting and you give up the bag to whoever shows up. I say to myself that, well, I need confirmation of your order by another individual higher than you to tell me this.
So might we assume then that if you had given the real pouch over at the first meet, everything else might not have happened that did happen?
That's possible. Either that or somebody would have nailed me before I made it back to the States.
Okay, what would have been their motive for nailing you?
Knowing that what we had just done, that we had stole those documents, what we had done.
Pretty interesting stuff. There's a few questions that that excerpt that we just aired bring to mind. One is that he, on the interview that he did prior to that interview with Rentz, with Greg on the 14th, he stated that he had, in fact, opened one of the documents before his arrest on December 6th. Which I am at a loss to explain why Rupert and Vreeland in that particular instance said that that was very specifically not the case when he had contradicted that statement days before.
Can I also note that in my conversation last night at around 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning with Mr. Vreeland, he said, when I told him that I was pulling material from the Rentz interview, he said, there's some contradictions in there. And I said, where? And he says, oh, in there somewhere.
Pretty interesting. The other thing is that he was at a wedding on a, what we've established is a Wednesday night at around the time my radio show starts.
In December.
Yes. In a white limousine with a bunch of other limousines. That, I mean, I don't know. It could have been a late party, maybe.
That's conspicuous.
I mean, the bars are still open at that time, but geez.
Conspicuous travel.
And how would he have known that there was a wedding happening?
He checked it out. He said so in the... you know, these are questions that we have that we would love to have answers to.
And if he's listening, he can call us at...
Please feel free.
416-595.
He knows the number.
1655.
He knows the number. Oh, but it is interesting to note, and it does tend to lend more credibility to his story, that the Toronto Police Fugitive Squad ripped the limousine apart. Not that we know that for a fact to be true, but I imagine there must have been some evidence presented at his trial to corroborate that. As many of his other statements have been corroborated to some extent in court here in Toronto as well. From the Oakland County Sheriff's Department website, they speak of his capture. Of course, he's one of their most wanted fugitives up until December 6th. It says here, on Thursday, December 7th, 2000, Delmart Vreeland was taken into custody by the Toronto Police Fugitive Squad to answer charges pending in Oakland County and various other states. Vreeland had been incarcerated in a Toronto jail on local fraud charges using an alias name of Michael Christian. A male friend of Vreeland notified the Toronto Police Fugitive Squad that they were holding a person in their jail under the name of Christian and that his real name was Delmart Vreeland, who was wanted all over the United States. Then it says, verification of the identity was made with the Oakland County Sheriff's Department through prints and photographs. Michael Christian was positively identified as Delmart Vreeland. There are many hearings. He's originally taken to the Don Jail, but subsequently was taken to Lindsay. As we know from Mike Rupert's excellent reports, Lieutenant Vreeland was attacked while in jail in Canada. If you want to read about that, all of Rupert's work along with that is posted at copvcia.com, as he pointed out in the interview we did with him.
What happened, according to Mike Vreeland, Delmart Vreeland, was that he was kept in solitary confinement for 2 months.
That's right. And that this seems a little odd as well for somebody who's, you know, been told, apparently when he was arrested, that he was charged with fraud. I mean, it was 2 months in solitary confinement, no lawyer, no family, seems like a little odd in that kind of a situation.
Maybe I'm jumping ahead here, but there's no indication that within that two-month period that any suggestion was made to the authorities about the story about him being in Moscow, about Mark Bastion, about documents, and so on. There's no indication of this.
There came a point in June of 2000, where Delmar Vreeland...
2001.
2001, my mistake.
And also, it should be noted that...
He made the same mistake in the interview.
He made the same mistake in the interview we did on the International Connection.
But we gather June of 2001, in fact, he wrote a letter to Mark Bastian from jail through the director of CSIS and the Canadian Embassy in Moscow. As a result of his letter, the RCMP and CSIS contacted his lawyer, Paul Slansky, and a meeting was set up in jail with Vreeland, where he was told by the RCMP and CSIS that Mark Bastian was in fact dead, at which time Vreeland claims, he says, that he said, well, then he was murdered, and I think we have a clip probably deals with this, once again from the Rents interview. So we'll have a listen to this to bring us to this point in the story.
Well, first what I did is I had some contact with my lawyers, and I explained some things to them. And I told them who I needed to talk to. I wanted them to go and speak to CSIS. I told my lawyers that I had wrote a letter to the director of CSIS, and that in that letter, I had asked him to forward another letter, which was enclosed in there, to Mark Bastian at the Canadian Embassy in Moscow.
Asking for?
Telling Mark that I am in jail.
Help.
Mm-hmm. And what is going on,
mm-hmm.
and explaining to him that I've got everything and it's safe, but what's going on?
He knew you had the papers.
Oh, yeah. But I wanted him to know that I had got back safely.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know if he knew where I was or not.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they threw me in jail and left me locked down in a hole for 2 months with no communication with anybody, there's no telling what he could have been thinking had he been alive, had somebody not murdered him.
But you didn't know at the time.
I had no clue he was dead at the time.
Yeah. All right, so you wrote to CSIS.
And then actually CSIS contacted the RCMP NSIS. NSIS contacted Paul Slansky, and they asked to have a meeting with me. They contacted them and said that they wanted to have a meeting with me at the jail. So the meeting was set up, and they came out, and we had some discussions, and it was at that time that they told Paul and Rocco that Bastian was definitely dead. And I told them to their face, I said, well, if he's dead, then somebody murdered him over there, and this is what took place. And they basically said, well, no, that's not true. He died of a natural cause. And I said, well, exactly what do you call a natural cause? And they wouldn't elaborate on exactly how it was, but they said that it was an overdose. He had done drugs. And I told them, I said, well, if you bring me a copy of his toxicology report, I will tell you exactly what's in it and exactly what they did to him, considering the people that were involved and the type of things that they do.
Mm-hmm.
That meeting took place during the month of August. It was around August 8th. They wanted to tape record the entire interview, and I told them, if you want to tape the interview, what you need to do is you need to guarantee me safe haven and asylum in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're asking me to commit treason against the United States by speaking to you and violating the National Security Act of 1947. So there's no question about the fact that I did that. I violated the National Security Act of 1947.
Mm-hmm.
But
of course, if ONI says you're not working for them, maybe
the point,
you didn't.
I made that point earlier when I was talking to somebody. If they say I don't work for them, then I'm not violating anything.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, while we're having our conversation, and I just told him, I said, look, when they start bombing New York, don't come back to me whining about it, asking me for more information, because you're not going to get any.
Why did you say that?
Because I knew exactly what they were going to do.
Who's they?
Individuals who were planning on attacking the United States.
And how did you know that?
I knew it from the documents that I had brought back from Russia.
When did you have the documents translated?
I translated four documents during the month of July.
Okay, so...
Now, can I just take something that I notice in there?
Just first quickly,
yeah,
I just mention that this contradicts what Rupert said in the interview that we did with him that we played for you earlier in the show. Very clearly he states there that the meeting he had with the RCMP and CSIS was in fact in August.
Yes.
Rather than, as Rupert claims, shortly after his his incarceration.
Correct.
And arrest on December 6th.
The other thing that I think is interesting to note there is that Vreeland makes clear that he tried to make a deal with the Canadian government that if they were to simply tape record his testimony,
right,
that would automatically gain him a refugee status in Canada, therefore eliminating the possibility of him being extradited to the United States. He tried to circumvent that at that point. He tried. What is unclear in the interview is whether the Canadian government agreed to that. Now, obviously, I would say they didn't.
No, I would say that that's correct because Mr. Vreeland has told both of us that, and Mr. Rupert, he alluded to it in the interview as well, that he has a hearing coming up in sometime this summer or early fall. It depends, you know, who's giving you the information, really.
Right.
I guess certainly we can try to find out from his lawyers at some point. Yes. Shortly after this is when he claims to have written the note that we were discussing earlier in the show, the Exhibit N. As I mentioned, we would be calling it the note from that point on. Do you have any remarks on tape that have to do with the note itself?
Yes, but I also have some information here which sort of works into the last clip about how the documents were translated while he was in prison, because essentially he starts referring to documents while he's incarcerated that were unsealed when he was in jail.
Yes, he claims to have only opened one of the documents prior to his arrest on December 6th. The rest of them somehow he has gotten access to the contents of during the time he was in jail.
Who did the translations? I don't want to name. Someone you knew in the business who was fluent in Russian and English?
It was done with an electronic translator.
Scanned?
Yes.
So you did it by yourself?
No, I didn't do it by myself. I had somebody help me translate the document. It would be kind of hard for me to have a computer system inside the jail.
And how did the data come back to you in the jail from your friend, your accomplice, or whoever helped you do this?
It was downloaded into my computer system. Prior to the 6th of December, I opened one document.
The rest of them were opened again in July?
In July.
Yeah, that's some months later.
Yes.
Did you have that first document translated?
I didn't have to translate the first one. The first document was in English.
Did it say anything particularly earth-shaking?
Yes. That was the reason why I asked to speak to the Canadian military at that time. It was basically a warning of something that was going to go down in September.
The documents you opened then in July and had translated, what were their contents, approximately?
The one document was a letter that was from Iraq to Moscow, and once it was translated, it was point specific on exactly what was going to happen in New York to the World Trade Center in September.
How specific was that letter in its description of what was due to happen in September?
Point specific. The only thing it didn't have was the exact day. It spoke of September 11th. It didn't say September 11th. It said September.
Okay.
It said World Trade Center. It specifically named that target in that month. And then it spoke on issues that were to, or things that were to happen after September.
Did it talk about the technology involved to inflict the damage on the target it named?
No, it did not say anything about we're going to fly airplanes into the World Trade Center. It was not that point specific. Basically, this letter was explaining to Moscow exactly what they were going to do. So I'm assuming that it's saying that we, as in Moscow, or we as a whole, Moscow and Iraq.
All right. Did the letter make it very clear in your mind that there was collusion between Iraq and Moscow?
There had to be, without a doubt.
I want to clarify something here in that I've had a number of conversations with Mike, and maybe I'm hearing something differently now. We had never discussed that Russia was the prime mover behind the attacks. Is that what you're saying now?
No, I'm not saying they were the prime movers. What I'm saying is that this letter was a letter from Iraq to Moscow explaining to them what they were going to do.
There have been a number of alleged warnings, incidentally, that we've been reading about since September 11th that came out of Russia. One that came out very quickly was a reported article in Pravda from July of 2001, several articles, in fact, where they tell people in Russia to get rid of their American dollars because the American dollar is facing a financial collapse because of terrorist attacks in the United States, which were believed apparently by people as high up as the head of state, Putin, as Mike Rupert mentioned earlier, that in fact terrorist attacks were going to happen in the United States. The article in July in Pravda guessed incorrectly that the attacks were going to, in fact, take place in August, late August, and of course we all remember they happened in early September. Still, I think that that this is yet another connection to Russia. The Economist, who made the allegations of the impending attacks in the Russian press, I believe her last name is Koryagina, K-O-R-Y-A-G-I-N-A. If anyone's interested in looking that up on Google, it's you'll find a couple different pieces that refer to these articles in Pravda, which I've just mentioned.
It should also be noted that, and it was in the interview that you heard earlier with Michael Rupert, who is the voice that comes in there occasionally.
Yes, in when, the Rents
In the Rents interview, Rents.com. Thank you, Jeff Rents, for allowing us to use that. That Rupert doesn't rule out or indeed confirms that Mike Vreeland had access to computers while in jail.
Yeah.
He could have been doing research. I mean, there's that possibility.
Lieutenant Vreeland's contention that rather than this being a warning note per se, it's part of another document which, when in the hands, it's part of a larger document, I should say, when in the hands of people who know more about these events than ourselves, for example, people in intelligence communities, those people might be able to interpret this note in a way that we're simply unable to.
And I have an explanation of that, and I can play that. It's under a minute.
That would be great.
Well, basically what I was doing is I was writing a 37-page letter to Admiral Vernon Clark. He's the chief of naval operation. I was going to give it to my attorneys and have them ship it to him. What I had done was I wrote that note that you see was basically nothing more than a note to myself, which contained all the relevant issues. But I did not put them in any specific order because I didn't want anybody else grabbing it and seeing it and figuring out what exactly it is that's in that letter. Because even though you see that note, people don't know exactly what that note means. They see names, they see places, but they don't know exactly what it means, other than the top portion. That's self-explanatory. But there are lines and slashes and backslashes and arrows that point to specific things, and each one, if you take it apart, it's like a puzzle you have to put together that forms sentences.
Okay, so that brings us up to the point where we actually start finding out about the story. We, the news readers of Greater Toronto, find an article in the Toronto Star dated October 2001 in which award-winning journalist named Nick Prawn describes certain events that took place at the trial. Recently, some of remarks that Mr. Prawn's made since then were used as evidence by Norman Solomon that aired on KPFA. We'll excerpt parts of it on Please Kill Me this week. Sorry, Norman Solomon alleges that Nick Prawn of the Toronto Star said to him in a telephone conversation this week that, in fact, no corroborating evidence was presented to back up any of these claims. Mr. Vreeland and his attorneys most strongly state that, in fact, there were, in fact, many corroborating witnesses that were called to testify at various hearings that have taken place so far. As Mike Rupert mentions, this fantastic telephone call that was made from the courtroom to the Pentagon switchboard, in which they were able to, in fact, determine that or confirm Lieutenant Vreeland's posting and the office where he was alleged supposedly working in the Pentagon. I spoke to Nick Prawn earlier this week, and he, in fact, didn't quite say things exactly as Norman Solomon alleges. Nick Prawn says he wasn't actually present during the entire trial. He was interested in mainly because of some evidence that Vreeland was giving, and I don't have Mr. Prawn's article in front of me right now. I must have left it in the other room.
And there are indications.
But he was supposed to be giving evidence in the alleged attempted or conspiracy to assassinate a judge here in Toronto. That was a result of some contact that Mr. Vreeland had while he was in the Don jail in Toronto with another prisoner who was said to be part of this plot to kill a judge.
Vreeland suggested that he held tape recordings of the interview that he did with Nick Prawn.
Not only that, but he was supposed to bring down stuff today that which would have been recordings from some of the members of the military that had gotten in touch with him since he's made these allegations,
right.
and now, the story about his notes been revealed.
Now, let me just play a little segment here, it's under a minute, about the voicemail and how he managed to get these recordings, supposedly.
Right.
They know who I am.
Did you call ONI again?
I didn't give up on ONI. Basically, what they did is they passed it off to JAG, and then JAG started contacting me nonstop. I mean, they were just leaving voicemails for me. They started at the low end of JAG, and it moved all the way up to Captain McCarthy. They were basically telling me to call them right away, you know, call me at home. And you're talking about one of the highest members of JAG in the United States military, in the U.S. Navy, calling this petty criminal, if you want to say it that way, in jail. Saying, call me at home.
And this is in August?
Yes. And I have it on tape. I have all of them on tape.
You saved the voicemail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not stupid. It was stupid for them to leave it on my SATCOM.
Preposterously so, but what is the gist of the messages you're getting from JAG? What do they want?
They want me to give them the documents, shut up, waive extradition, and come back to the States. My response was no.
I have just some more information about this SATCOM business and how this satellite phone works and how he's able to download messages and get translations from remote computers while in jail, even though his computer isn't hooked up, supposedly.
Over the telephone. You know, I've looked into this a little bit, and I found a company that actually offers this service in the United States where you can check your email and have it read to you by phone. So I'm actually quite satisfied with that. With that explanation. Apparently, one of the ways he was able to get at some of the information in the documents was through a system that he operated an interface between a computer somewhere online and a normal telephone line. That's a really interesting part of it, I think.
He does at one point say something very mysterious. He says it's not available in the United States.
Yes. Only in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Pity.